I noticed this chair is more stable, but you tend to slide a little bit. Hopefully we'll not lose you off the front of the
hope. I'm worried about the trap door underneath. That bothers me.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Last week we digressed a little bit into, it is a little sloped. Stay awake. I have to stay awake. Last week we digressed a little bit into Adam, and I wanted to call your attention to the significance of Adam in the Bible as the founder of the human race, the father of us all, and the fact that there are two Adams in the Bible. There's the first Adam and the last Adam, and these are compared and contrasted in the New Testament. We all were born into the world in the first Adam. We're members of his great extended family. When we are born again, spiritually reborn, by the new birth and by adoption, we are taken out of the family of the old Adam and put into the family of the last Adam. And we're made brand new men and women, and we are participating in a whole new creation. And it's important to realize that the big difference in being a child of Adam, number two, instead of number one, because we can't have the freedom and power to live as the second Adam did. Now, it's also true that other people who are mentioned here in Genesis show up in the New Testament. For example, 2 weeks ago we talked about Cain and Abel. Cain, the first murderer, the first son of Adam and Eve, turns out to be a killer and kills his younger brother. And the New Testament comments on that. Let me just point those out and you can make a note if you want. Hebrews 11:4 says, by faith, Cain offered by faith Abel offered a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and through his faith being dead still speaks. So Abel didn't have a chance to live a very full life. He was a righteous man, and he's still speaking to us by his faith, which caused him to offer to God a sacrifice that was pleasing to God. And so he's in the hall of fame of Hebrews 11. 1 John 3:2, speaking to all of us, don't be like Cain, who was of the wicked one, and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his works were evil and his brother's were righteous. It's interesting that two individuals can offer a sacrifice to God, and from all outward appearances they both look acceptable, but as far as God's concerned, the sacrifice of one of them is considered wicked and the other one is considered righteous, night and day. And that's all, in this case, due to the motives of the heart. Jude 11 says, woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain and run greedily in the way of Balaam for profit. Talking about false teachers, that Jude is very significant. There's all kinds of stuff packed into Jude, but the comparison between Cain and Abel comes out in Jude. The way of Cain, the lifestyle of Cain, is mentioned as typical of lifestyle of apostates, people that fall away. Hebrews 12:24 says that we should look to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks of better things than that of Abel. So Abel's shed blood is put in a list of honorable sacrifices pleasing to God in Hebrews 12. Matthew 23 and Luke 11, Jesus mentions Abel. Could any of you guess what that's about? Why Jesus would bring up Abel in talking to the Pharisees? He accused the Pharisees of being responsible for the blood of all the martyrs down through the ages, of which the first martyr was Abel. So Abel is the first in a long line of people who essentially given their lives for the Lord. So It's important if you get out your concordance to look up these names. I want to move on today. We're getting way behind here. And look at chapter 5. Notice how chapter 4 closes. Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth. For she said, God has appointed for me another child instead of Abel, for Cain slew him. What does the name Seth mean?
Granted.
Yeah, granted or appointed. To Seth also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. At that time, men began to call on the name of the Lord. That last verse, what does that mean? Let me mention it real quick. At that time in history, men began to call on the name of the Lord.
Began to recognize
him, but it, probably in a corporate sense. He probably began to have prayer meetings instead of just privately praying to God. Okay? Now, chapter 5. This is an interesting chapter. And first of all, notice how it starts. This is the book of the generations of Adam. Is that significant?
Yes.
What does that mean? Why is that little introduction put there?
To show the line to Christ.
Yes. Remember how Genesis is put together, apparently? It's put together in tablets. Probably a bunch of tablets, or probably CDs or something got handed to Moses while he was in the wilderness, and he transcribed them all and wove them together into the five books of Moses. So he had source material. It might have been oral. We don't know. It probably wasn't God dictating it. But if that's true, this tablet model for Genesis, then who wrote chapter 1? God himself did. There weren't any people around to take notes. And then from chapter 2 up to right here, who's been the one that's been recording this for us?
Adam.
Now, Adam dies pretty quick along in here. Do you suppose that would have any influence on what we just finished reading about in chapter 4? Where does chapter 4 stop? It stops essentially at about the time that Adam died. And notice that the line of Cain is abbreviated. It's shorter. Well, that would be logical that Adam is not able to keep track of all of his relatives, his 100,000 or million descendants by the time he died. And so the account is a little abbreviated. Maybe if they ever find Noah's Ark on board in the Macintosh computer that they have in the main, in the private cabins, that we may get a readout and be able to get a lot more. The diary of Noah would be something nice to recover, wouldn't it? Chapter 5. This is the book of the generations of Adam. So from here on out, the author of what follows is probably
Moses.
Who? The tablet.
Yeah.
Could be Seth, but it also could be Noah. Okay, there's a change of authors at verse 5. This is the book of the generations of Adam, closes the previous section. When God, now, so naturally, the new writer here is going to give us a little short review. Remember when we talked about chapter 2 of Genesis? It started with a little review. Adam is reviewing a little bit of his own history from what God had taught him. This is the book of the generations of Adam. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. Male and female, he created them, and he blessed them and called them man. He literally called them Adam when they were created. That's a little brief little summary. Does that fit what we know about Genesis 1 and 2? Yes. And here we have the fact that the word man is very often in the Bible generic. All those times in the New Testament where the apostle or some writer tells us that speaks to us as brothers, he means brothers and sisters. He means men and women, unless it's otherwise stated. So here, Adam means mankind. It means all of us, all right? God originally created us male and female and called us mankind. When we were created. So that's what verse 2 says. The other thing that's interesting here, when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. Now, verse 3. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, after his image, and he named him Seth. Any change there? Yeah, the first Adam is made in the image of God, and now what about all subsequent human beings in the image of their father? The image of God has been reduced greatly, huh?
Is there any significance in him saying how old he is when Seth is born? I mean, I can understand, like, how long he lived.
This is really interesting. There's a whole bunch of interesting things that we're thinking about. I don't know the answer. Human beings are going to live almost 1,000 years before the flood. Nobody here seems to have children very early. They don't run out after high school and get married and have four kids. They're 100 years old when they have children. We're going to see in this chapter that the average family size would appear to be about how many?
Five.
Five, yeah. About five. Now, you can do population statistics and population growth. If you have five kids per family in the course of 2,000 years, you quickly fill the earth with people, billions of people, just overflowing with people. And that's in fact, that five is a lot of kids on the average to have. If the evolutionist was true and man and woman began to reproduce on the earth, billion years ago or even a million years ago, the whole universe would be full of dead bodies right now. That's the capacity of the human race. I'll bring you a graph on this because the growth of populations is almost exponential. It's very rapid. But let's see if there's any interesting clues in here that we could learn anything. It seems to be that the most important thing for the author wants us to see here, the writer, is when the next in line is born, the heir to the family estate. The days of Adam after he became the father of Seth were 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters. Sons plural, daughters plural, that means at least two sons, at least two daughters, plus the firstborn, that's five. There's the five. But it could have been more. The problem with larger families is this population runs out of control.
First time
daughter, yes.
What?
First time daughters are mentioned.
It seems to be having all these kids, and I couldn't figure out
where the girls are. Where they're where they come from? Mars, Venus, I think. So it does. It goes on to say that Adam had other sons and daughters, and he lived up to a total of 930 years. And then we get that wonderful expression, "and he died." That's repeated eight times here in this chapter. And he died, and he died, and he died. Story of everybody's life all the way down through the whole Bible. Very sad. When Seth had lived 105 years, he became the father of Enosh. Seth lived after the death of Enosh 807 years, and he had other sons and daughters. The days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. How do you suppose they managed birth control back then if you started having children at 100 years of age and you lived another 800 years? You would think they had lots and lots of kids.
Are you leaving out a word that I'm reading in here? All these guys said, "and then he died." And then he died.
I don't know if there's a "then" in Hebrew or not. Who's our Hebrew scholar here today? John Aniker is our Greek. I'll have to look into that and look at the see if
they accomplished all these things. They accomplished all these things, and after they had accomplished them,
they just died. Yeah. Now, during this whole time period between Adam and Noah, some people are coming to know the Lord, and some are not. Abel knew the Lord. He was righteous. His brother Cain did not know the Lord. Cain's descendants all headed off on their own. Some of the people in the line of Cain probably came to know the Lord. We're getting the main line here, the line of redemption that leads to Noah, that's going to eventually lead to the Messiah. all the other things about the human race that branch off are just dropped. They're just not of interest to the writer here. The Bible is a book about redemption. That's what it's focusing on. Verse 9. When Enosh had lived 90 years, he had children real early, age 90. He became the father of Kenan. Enoch lived after the birth of Kenan 815 years and had other sons and daughters. All the days of Enosh were 905 years, and he died. Healthy, long life. Do you imagine how many grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, great-great-great-grandchildren you would have if you lived 900 years? Think of sending Christmas cards. Think of Thanksgiving.
Yes. In the garden.
Yeah.
So they probably have sickness and illness and had so many.
Now this is a very good point. We don't know.
Because they lost some of them.
God made Adam and Eve to live in a garden in an unfallen world. Were they able to adjust to germs and bugs and opportunistic infections? And did the immune system switch right on after the fall? We do have a wonderful functioning immune system that responds to harmful germs and bacteria, automatically runs all the time. Did that turn on all of a sudden, or was there a learning curve? Because it's very possible they had a lot of children die in infancy. On the other hand, all the parents lived up to healthy 900 and some years, and there was not very much damage in the genome back then, and Adam was a lot smarter than we are, and they were much closer to God than we were, and we're way down on the list of deterioration.
Could be wars.
We don't know anything about wars and fightings. They probably had a lot of crime and violence, running around killing each other to a great extent. Wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
What's with the bacteria and the mutations that have evolved?
Well,
could you repeat that just so everyone can... were there the bacteria and mutations that had... Were they...
Probably not in the garden. There were no probably harmful germs, bacteria, thorns, thistles. This is part of the curse on the earth. God caused the earth to be less bountiful and less fruitful as a result, consequence of the fall. So I think that's when weeds began to proliferate, and thorns and thistles and mosquitoes and no-see-ums, and little nasty bugs and germs, yeah.
And also, of course, they didn't have all of the different chemicals and the stuff that we're ingesting with all the weird food, so that all they could eat was just stuff in the ground.
We know absolutely, practically nothing about this civilization before the flood. It's generally called the time period of the antediluvians. A-N-T-E means before diluvia, flood, before the flood. The ante room at your house is the room outside of your main living room. Antediluvians. 2,000 years is a long time for a world to become heavily populated, for civilizations to rise and fall. There are no nations at this time. Everything's kind of patriarchal, with a lot of rivalry between patriarchs, a lot of animosity and jealousy, and who knows, did they primarily develop an agricultural way of life, or did they build rocket ships and travel to distant planets? We don't know. Did they build great skyscrapers? They could well have in 2,000 years. Look what's happened in our country in 200 years. We just don't know. We have only those little hints in there about music in the name Jubal for Jubilee, and in his brother, the hint of metalworking, maybe a hint of technology, but that's about all we have. We just know nothing, which is why I want to get on Noah's Ark and get the records off of the computer if we can. Okay. Where did I stop? Verse 12. When Kenan had lived 70 years, he became the father of Mahalalel. Kenan lived after the birth of Mahalalel 840 years, and he had other sons and daughters, and all the days of Kenan were 910 years, and he died. When Mahalalel had lived 65 years, he became the father of Jared. He got married right after high school. Only 65. Became the father of Jared. He lived after the birth of Jared 830 years, had other sons and daughters. We don't know who they are. They aren't named. They all grew up and had kids and moved to Peoria or Chicago or whatever. We don't know. All the days of Mahalalel were 995 years, and he died. Getting a little monotonous there. He died. And his wife died, and his sons and his daughters died. That's the whole idea here. When Jared had lived 162 years, he waited a long time. I guess he could see that raising kids was a big chore, so he waited a while, because he was 162. And then he gave birth to a boy named Enoch. Jared lived after the birth of Enoch 800 years, and had other sons and daughters, and all the days of Jared were 962 years, and he died. Now we get an interesting little break in the narrative. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. You've probably heard that name before. Enoch walked with God after the birth of Methuselah 300 years, and he had other sons and daughters. All the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God and was not. One word in Hebrew, disappeared. And he disappeared, doesn't mean he died. When Enoch had lived 365 years, he became the father of Methuselah. Enoch walked with God after the birth of Methuselah 300 years and had other sons and daughters. And all the days of Enoch were 365 years. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Now that is strange. What in the world is going on there?
Noether walked with God.
We had first time we have any reference to somebody walking with God. What does it mean to walk with God? It's a fellowship. It's being on the same path, going in the same direction, agreeing with each other. That's what that all means. Ray Sedman likes to talk about walking as a series of controlled falls. You put one foot out, and then you lean your whole weight over on it, and then you put your other foot out and lean your whole weight on that, and you can fall at any minute, like small children do, or us older people do. But a walk has that tentativeness to it.
On verse 24, of course I don't have the tape, but many years ago they had these Congress on Biblical Exposition, and J.I. Packer gave an hour and 15-minute sermon on verse 24. So just to meditate on what that means.
This is interesting. Now, Enoch is mentioned in the New Testament. It says in the New Testament that he was a preacher of righteousness. He's an evangelist, like Billy Graham, and that he had a vision of something, an important vision that profoundly affected his life. What did he see in this great vision? I think that's Jude, isn't it? Somebody knows that. He saw the Lord coming with his 10,000 saints. He had a vision of the coming of the Lord. Was that the coming of the Lord, which hasn't happened yet? Yes, could be. Also the coming of the Lord at the flood. So he had a view of impending judgment that was coming upon the whole world. And that probably shook him up pretty good, don't you suppose? He might have been a pretty careless, typical churchgoer before the flood, just being a Christian, following God as kind of a hobby. And then he had this vision that shook him up and scared him. And he paid attention with God and walked with God, and God just said, well, you can come on home now with me. He was raptured. He was caught up. Has that ever happened to anybody else in the Bible?
Yes.
Elijah. Elijah was walking along with his understudy, Elisha, and he was caught up in a great whirlwind. I remember, and he threw his mantle back to Elisha and was caught up and didn't die. Anybody else? Well, all of us, if the Lord comes back today, we'll all get caught up without seeing death. So these people, now there's something else that happened in this time period, because the son that's born here at Methuselah turns out to be the oldest man that ever lived. What does the name Methuselah mean?
His death shall bring it.
Yes, his death shall bring it, or when he dies it will come. That's pretty clear. In other words, when this young Methuselah, this boy, the son of yours, dies, the flood's going to come and destroy the whole world. So you want to watch that Methuselah, make sure he doesn't get a cold, make sure he's got a warm coat for that when he goes off to school, keep him healthy.
And that would line up with the what Jude says about Enoch talking about the coming judgment.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So Enoch, as a great evangelist of that day, is no doubt speaking to the whole world, as many people as he can get access to. Was there a CNN in those days? Was there a Fox News? I don't know. There might have been mass communication. God's always been interested in the human race. The world now could easily have billions of people in it. The message of the gospel goes out, probably hardly any we're listening to it, but the message here is a clear warning. When Methuselah dies, that means the flood will take place. And so the whole world watches this Methuselah. Is he going to die young? Is he going to get killed in a traffic accident? Is he going to overdose on drugs? Is something going to happen bad to him? Well, isn't it wonderful of God that he lived 969 years? And then the flood did, in fact, come.
I don't know. I think Ray said that was a demonstration of God's grace, that the oldest recorded life was the one that was set as the timeline for the flood.
Yeah, God's grace and mercy to the last possible minute. So Enoch, this is an important guy. The seventh from Adam. There are 10 generations in here between Adam and Noah. All right. Verse 25. When Methuselah had lived 187 years, he became the father of Lamech. Methuselah lived after the birth of Lamech 782 years, and he had other sons and daughters, and all the days of Methuselah were 900 years and 69, and he died. He was probably a pretty godly man. The father like that had taught him about his life and the significance of his life. When Lamech had lived 182 years, he became the father of a son, and he called his name Noah. Now we've got Noah here. And a little more editorial comment, called his name Noah, saying, out of the ground which the Lord has cursed, this one, this little boy Noah, shall bring us relief from our work and from the toil of our hands. What's the name Noah mean?
Comfort.
Comfort or rest. So Noah is going to be the one that brings us rest from our trials and troubles. And all the days, Lamech lived after the birth of Noah 595 years, and he had other sons and daughters. And all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. After Noah was 500 years old, Noah became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. That's unusual because it doesn't mention any daughters. Doesn't mention any other children, just these three boys. Yeah.
There weren't any daughters mentioned as firstborn anything here.
No.
They're all sons.
That's that.
Yeah. It's like only the first son is important in the lineage, I guess.
Well, in the recorded record, I'm sure.
He had more sons than daughters.
In reality, I think there's an unwritten story here of what the women were doing in the meantime, and how significant and important they were in history. But God wants us to focus on the redemptive line that points to the Messiah. All this other stuff that the Lord considers as peripheral, we can talk about that in heaven and find out about it. The women are certainly significant.
Yeah, they bore just, the kids.
And they have to raise these kids. Now, Ray Steadman has looked up the meaning of all these names here and strung them all together, and we just read this long list of names that all end up with "and he died." And let me show you what Ray says about this chapter. A way of escape for man is indicated again in a most fascinating way in this chapter by the meaning of the names listed. There is some difference among authorities as to the meaning of these names. depending upon the route from which they are judged to be taken. But one authority gives a most interesting sequence of meanings. This means, if you look up the Hebrew words and you look up what the root word means, it has meaning. And here's Ray's list. The list begins with Seth, which means appointed. Enosh, his son, means mortal. And his son, Kenan, means sorrow. His son, Mahalalel, means the blessed God. He named his boy Jared, which means came down. And his boy Enoch means teaching. Methuselah, as we've already seen, means his death shall bring. Lamech means strength, and Noah, comfort. Put all these together, and you have
Jesus.
God has appointed that mortal man shall sorrow, but the blessed God came down, teaching that his death shall bring strength and comfort. Is this book from God? Ray asks. You notice here that this interpretation only works in the Hebrew language. It doesn't work in any other language. And there's another suggestion that Hebrew or something like Hebrew was the original language of mankind before the Tower of Babel. God has written Methuselah on each one of us. His death shall bring it, or when he dies it will come. How far is it until the end of the world for you? When you die, that's the end of the world for you. That's the second coming of Christ. That's the end of man's day. Is it 50 years from now, or 10, or tomorrow? Who knows? But at any moment, when he dies, it will come.
I said, is it forbidden that comfort and rest will come, or the flood will come?
Well, there's comfort coming for who? For everybody who's on the ark. Not for the rest of the world. You notice that just the rest of the world is lost. And that's billions of people. Yeah.
It's shorter now than it was a week ago.
Yes, it's good. Yeah, the time's gotten 7 days shorter than it was last Sunday. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm still not clear. What does the it refer to? The flood or the comfort? Or is it going to go either way?
His death will bring strength and comfort for all of God's people. That's. That's the death of Methuselah, but it's also the death of Jesus is implied in that.
Because the ark is a type of Christ.
The ark is a type of Christ. Now, we get that in the next chapter. This is chapter 5 is kind of uninteresting except for these little tidbits. So let's get a little bit into chapter 6. We'll find out, we get some more interesting details. When man began to multiply on the face of the ground, and daughters were born to them. Now we have some daughters in here. When men began to multiply on the face of the ground and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were fair, and they took to wife such of them as they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh, but his days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men that were of old, the men of renown. Now this chapter in the Bible is one that really gets a lot of controversy among the commentators. And it's talking about the daughters of men. That's obviously human women. But the term sons of God here, Bene Elohim in Hebrew, occurs only four times in the Old Testament, and it always means angels, always. In the New Testament, we say sons of God, daughters of God, and it means believers. In the Old Testament, it always means angels. So here's this very strange passage that in the days before the flood, there was some kind of shenanigans going on between a group of angels who in some sense, some way intermarried with human women to give birth to a race of beings who were half men, half angel. They, like the Greek gods of mythology. That's the straightforward, usual meaning of this. The Nephilim that comes from the word fallen ones, were the giants of ancient times, the titans. How would this happen? The angels are not supposed to be sexual beings. No sex in heaven for the angels, at least. Maybe it was some kind of a demonic possession, some kind of tampering with the human genome that brought these creatures into the world. Some kind of Satan attempting to get his seed into the race and to destroy the human race by turning us into half-breeds and monsters and putting some kind of a huge damage.
Was this the line of Goliath?
Yes. Now this same thing happens after the flood also. So it used to be that this was thought that it was the daughters of Cain who were intermarrying with the it was the sons of Cain intermarrying with the daughters of Seth was where the problem was. But that if a non-Christian and a Christian marry, are their children half-breed monsters? No, never. And these Nephilim were like Goliath. Goliath was, 9-10 feet tall, extra fingers and toes. Og, king of Bashan, had the big iron bedstead. The bones of some of these guys have been found in archaeological sites in the Middle East. A race of giants. And I think that the best way to think about this race would be to look at the gods of Greek mythology and the Titans and all of the mythological stories. Where did the Greeks get those from? Now, if this is true, if beings came to Earth that were born of woman, but nevertheless didn't have human fathers, they would probably not be eligible for redemption. When they died, did their spirits wander around on the Earth as disembodied spirits? That's been one suggestion. I don't know whether much to support that or not. If they became disembodied spirits, those would be the kind of spirits that try to possess people demonically. Or the kind of spirits that Jesus told to go into the pigs when he at Gadara. This is a little speculative. I looked up about six recent Bible scholars like Ray Stedman and others, and put what they said about this chapter all on a page on my website called nephilim.html. That's in your references, and you can go look it up. Because all the leading scholars today have pretty well agreed that, weird and strange though this probably actually is what happened. Some kind of a very strange event. Now in the New Testament, you put together the things in the New Testament, in Peter and in Jude, it talks about a group of angels who have been taken out of the world and confined in a place called Tartarus until the judgment day. This group of angels who are responsible for this awful deed have been removed and are confined in a prison till the judgment of the great day. And this group of angels left their first estate, left the office that was assigned to them. Fallen angels, they stepped out of bounds, intermingled genetically with the human race to bring these monstrous beings into existence. Very weird and very strange.
God put it there for a reason.
God put it there for a reason. Now, the book of Enoch, the apocryphal book of Enoch, goes on at length about that. That's one of the uninspired books of the Bible, but it's got more details along this line. We still have the problem. We have the promise to Eve about the seed of the woman being the savior of the world, but we do have something about the seed of the serpent in there. To what extent will Satan succeed in manipulating and destroying the human genome or altering it so that he can bring a unique person into the world? Well, we don't know. Everything I'm telling you is pretty speculative because this right here is where it's about the only thing we know about it, plus Jude, plus 1st and 2nd Peter. All right? So we just kind of have to leave it there and pick up the little clues. Nephilim. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward. Also after the flood. Was that a different incident? And that now when it's after the flood, we know a lot more about these giants because some of them live up in the Golan Heights and some live at near, where did Abraham live? Hebron. Hebron. There was a race of giants at Hebron that Joshua and Caleb went in during the conquest, and Caleb decided that he wanted the land around Hebron for himself, and he had to get the giants cleared out of there. And David with Goliath, that's the example of these huge human-like beings that were evil and destructive and not fully human in some weird way. Well, I'm sure we can go to the library in heaven and check out a good video on this and heavenly YouTube, I suppose, or something. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and afterward when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and they bore children to them. That's just very strange. These were the mighty men, that's a negative word, that were of old, the men of renown. I like to think of them as the Greek titans. Now, it's all kind of connected here. We're coming down to the time period just before the flood. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great, unusually intense, excuse me, in Hebrew. The wickedness of man was unusually intense, and every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. The Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. Some of your Bibles will say it repented him that he had made man. Does God repent? No. What does it mean here about what's going on with God? He feels enormous grief and sorrow at the state of mankind with just a few people hanging on to the truth. Just a few. And don't we live in a time right now of great wickedness in the earth?
Yes.
What's the difference here? Is there a difference in the kind of wickedness here? Well, every imagination of the thoughts of the heart was only evil continually. You think we're quite that bad yet? Well, probably not. Continually evil. Evil, inventing evil all the time, deliberately being evil, destructive, anti-God. Yeah. We're getting some clues about the horrendous kinds of violence that break out and the terrible crimes that are just unthinkable that you wouldn't imagine ever happening are in the daily news now. Horrendous evil things going on. So it's getting there. Now the Lord was sorry that he made man on the earth. It grieved him. Yet God has a broken heart over the human race whom he loves. Loves everybody. So the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the ground, man and beast. Human behavior, human sin influences the animal world and the creation. Man and beast and creeping things and birds of the air, I'm sorry that I've made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God, had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So God's getting ready to destroy the earth in a great judgment. He's going to tell us in a minute that it's going to be 100 years. They've got 100 years of notice here. And Noah is evidently important in what's going to happen. And he has three sons. Are these sons triplets? No. Can you tell? They're always listed in this order, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, always. Who's the oldest?
No.
Japheth is the oldest, unless you can correct me, and Ham's the youngest. But they're always listed. Is there a reason why they're listed, Shem, Ham, and Japheth? That's extra credit. We'll get into that when we get a little further into Genesis. The earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh. The earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark. He tells Noah now, make yourself a big boat of gopher wood. Don't know exactly what gopher wood is. Make rooms in the ark. That's where nests or living places in the ark. Cover it inside and out with pitch, asphalt, tar. This is how you are to make it. The length of the ark is 300 cubits. How much is a cubit?
18 inches.
About 18 inches. That's the length of the king's from the king's elbow to the king's fingertip. It's usually 18 inches. So make yourself this big barge that will float very well in your driveway, 500 miles from the ocean. No, you don't have a trailer under this big boat. So your neighbors are going to laugh at you for 100 years while you're building this boat. And every once in a while, a reporter will come by from the Fox News and say, here's crazy Noah. Let's see how he's doing on the boat. And he's got his three sons working with him, but he might even have hired help. I don't know. He could have. And it's a big, big boat. But if you have 100 years and strong, able-bodied people who live to be 900 years old, it's doable. Its breadth is 50 cubits, 75 feet. Its height is 30 cubits, 45 feet. Make a roof over the ark and finish it for a cubit, 18 inches above. Big window with an umbrella over it. Put one door in the ark in its side, not a separate door for insects and another door for frogs and another door for people. It's one door in the side of the ark, not in the top. Make it with three decks, upper, lower, and third decks. That would be reasonable if the people lived on the top deck and the animals lived on the second deck, and the third deck below is where you throw all the refuse. I don't know, but that would be reasonable. Is this boat big enough to hold the known two of all the animals that we know about? Yes, it is. Several calculations on that. I could look them up if you want, but it's plenty big enough. A lot of species have, in fact, gone extinct since the time of Noah. You read about that all the time, about species that are dying out, not increasing. For behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life from under the heavens. Everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you. First time a covenant's mentioned here. I, God, will make a covenant with you, Noah, an agreement with you. And you shall come into the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your son's wife with you. That adds up to eight people. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. You shall be male and female. They shall be male and female. Of the birds according to their kinds, and the animals according to their kinds, of every creeping thing on the ground according to their kind, two of every sort shall come in to you to keep them alive. You have to take care of these animals, Noah. Also take with you every sort of food that is eaten and store it up. It shall serve as food for you and for them. Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him. We ought to back up and look at what it means that Noah was a righteous man and blameless. What did some of the other versions may even say, pure, or what did something verse 9?
Verse 9, yeah. Well, it says the same thing about that he said about Enoch.
Yeah.
He walked with God.
Yeah, been righteous, blameless. So no, that does that mean that Noah never sinned? No, it means that he had a clean slate before the Lord, that everything was had been forgiven and confessed. Now, this is quite a job building this big boat for 100 years in your driveway, a long way away from the ocean. If it was a local flood, you wouldn't think you'd go to that much trouble, right? You'd think you could easily go up on the neighboring hilltop and build it. Yeah.
I was a little confused. He said he's going to destroy all the creatures, all the animals.
Yeah. All the animals that are left on the earth that are there in the current setting are going to drown with the people of the flood. Now, this is billions of people, probably billions of people. It depends on your population growth calculations. Could have been greater than the world population is today. That's reasonable just on population growth. In fact, you have a hard time keeping the population reasonably low, which is why I mentioned that five children per family is a lot. Fills the earth up quickly with people. Now, what's going on for 100 years? And Adam, and this guy Noah is very conspicuous, and he's may even be on radio and television, and if they had such things. And does everybody know about crazy Noah? Probably. And what is Noah saying to the world?
Evangelizing.
He's evangelizing. He says, there is a place of safety and refuge for you to come into, and you will be safe. All you've got to do is come in to the ark. The ark then is a beautiful picture of Christ. It's a beautiful picture of coming in to Christ, who is the place of refuge, and we'll be tossed around a little bit in the coming flood, but we'll be safe. And meanwhile, outside the ark, everybody drowns. In 100 years of preaching, how many people flocked to his message and responded?
Zero.
Should God wait around much longer if nobody is interested? No, you're just filling the earth up with more evil people and more wickedness and more corruption. God has to act justly and mercifully, but there's no point in letting this go on and on and on and on. So that's the sad, terrible, tragic part about it. The word here for the ark is the same as, similar to the word for coffin. It's a coffin. And when we come into Christ, we're identified with Jesus in his death, burial, and resurrection. We certainly, the people on board the ark certainly died to their old life. They got on this big boat and God closed the door and it started to rain. And the next time they see land, everything's been swept away and all, whatever was there is gone. Whatever was there is buried under a couple of miles of sediments. So we don't have any fossils, no archaeological records from that time period. It's all gone. Nobody knows a thing about that time period. 2,000 years of human history. But we're going to get Noah and his three sons and their wives, total of 8 people, to repopulate the world. There's some new genetic studies that are coming out, the human genomes being studied all the way back into history, and you find out that there was originally one man and one woman, but there's some kind of a weird gap that occurs in which it would appear that the genome narrows down to, funnels down. And that's very likely the flood of Noah. My date for the flood, if you want to, as long as I'm being radical today, I would put the flood at about 3500 BC would be my date for the flood. And we can talk about that a little bit later. Next week, I want you to have a lot of questions for next week, okay? Because I throw a whole bunch of stuff to you, a big curveball out of the blue, and you can see that there's a lot here that we can talk about. I think time's all gone, isn't it? And thank you all.